Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
And welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Monday, May 1st, May Day. And it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri and I shall be your host for today as we continue our discussion with Jim Lawlor. Now, if you were here on Friday, you will see I was inundated by WhatsApp and text messages saying, bring back Jim. Bring back Jim. And I say, yes, he's the resident historian, which we delve in a new concept that every week we'll have Jim Lawlor come on and we'll speak an aspect of Bohemian history. What's big in Bohemian history? Because Bohemian want to know where we come from. Who are we self, right? And Jim Lawlor is a historian. Right, he is the vice president, confirming that he's the vice president of the Bahamas Historical Society of the Bahamas.
And correspondent secretary.
And bring the mic a little closer there to you, so I make sure they're clear. Make sure his mic is clear for me, their producer. And correspondent secretary. That means he communicates with people here and abroad about what's happening with the Historical Society. Right, and we delved in last week on what is the Historical Society, the importance of it, the great work they're doing. But today. Today we're telling Jim's story.
Just so we'll go ahead. About the newspaper, my news monthly newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
I announce the events, the talks.
One minute, producer. He's kind of muffled. Can you hear him a little bit better? Go ahead, Jim. Try it again.
Yeah, I send a newsletter out every month, mm-hmm. and in the newsletter I'll announce the current events, and then I give a fragment of history. Like last week, I gave some background on the glass window bridge at Eleuthera because my father-in-law, Paul Albury, had written about it. And so I was asked a couple of times by a couple of people about the glass window bridge. So I was able to share something about it.
And that's Jim Lawlor's job. Post-retirement, he corresponds and give detail. And just recently, he's communicated with some persons abroad who want to know about pirates in the Bahamas. So he's basically communicating them and giving them insight. And you can use your own words there, Jim, for me, about where they can go, what to see, and details about the Bahamas and piracy.
Oh, yeah. The Bahamas Historical Society have a museum, which is located on the corner of Shirley Street and Elizabeth Avenue. It's the old IODE, the Imperial Daughter of the Empire Building, who gave us the building in 1976, and we made it into a museum.
And before we transition to you, you said it's the old IOD. What does that mean?
The Imperial Order of the Daughters of the Empire.
And what is that?
That was an organization started in 1900. By the wife of the Canadian Prime Minister. I cannot remember her name at the moment, but within 4 years, there were five chapters of the IODE here. And basically, she started it to highlight Victoriana, you know, it was the final years of the Queen Victoria's reign. Queen Victoria died in 1901. And the Boer War was going on. So the, originally, it was like sort of like the Red Cross because it knitted uniforms for the troops and sent them provisions and that sort of thing. So in wartime, it was an aid to the soldiers and military. And in peacetime, acted much like the Red Cross. And actually, I think it was about 1939, a lot of the ladies from the IODE became the Bahamas Red Cross.
Okay, good. I just want to put that out there so people know that the building that you are housed is actually historical also and has a grander story and importance to the Bahamas.
But let's built in 1952.
1952. But let's start with you. Okay. We're going to start with you. People would realize that you have an accent. You have an English accent, but you live inside the Bahamas. I need to know the origin, your origin, and why you are here, how you get this English accent. So let's start with birth, parents, and then we transition to coming to the Bahamas.
Well, I was born in a place called Felling, which at that time was in County Durham. It's now changed to the Tyne and Wear. My father was James Lawler. I'm named James Lawler after him. He married my mother in 1938. She was Norma Rees. Unfortunately, my biological father died when I was two in the wartime. My mother married again when I was six, and we moved to Jarrow on Tyne. And I think I told you that Jarrow is the home of the Venerable Bede. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud of the Venerable Bede. He was reckoned to be the most learned man in Europe in the, sometime in the, like, the year 670 AD. Jarrow is also famous for a group of Jarrow marchers that marched on London to demand work because the shipbuilding industry was failing. It was also the home of Alan Price, who belonged to the Animals and had that famous hit, The House of the Rising Sun. And then my friend Steve Cram from Jarrow won the first 1,500 meters in the World Athletic Games in 1973 in Finland and held the world record at the mile at 356 point something. For 9 years in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. Jarrow is a very important place, although it's faded a bit since then.
So, but you left your home. How? Where did you leave your home? Why did you leave your home?
Okay. It's complicated. At the end of my school year, I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do. And it so turned out that I became an apprentice at Arrol and Company to manufacture switchgear and became an electrical engineer. At the same time, I was running and got an interest in running and coaching and loved coaching young athletes, and that decided me, like, I'd like to be a teacher. So I enrolled and did a 2-year course in technical teaching, and I was actually... I'd gone to Zambia. I was going to go to a technical college, but my company offered me more perks, the house, more cash and everything, so I took that. I had 2 years in Zambia where I coached the national team of Zambia. And then I went back to Britain, and I was kind of unsettled and wanted away again. So I applied for a technical teaching job in Mauritius. Mm-hmm. I was accepted for the job, but time went by, and I happened to be actually going to do a run in an athletics meet at the White City. So I went down to London and I thought, well, I'll go a day early and I'll go to the Ministry of Overseas Development that hired teachers for the colonies at that time. And when I got there, I found out that the funding for the college in Mauritius had fallen through, and they told me, we urgently need somebody in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'd like to do that. So I was interviewed by Joe Flint, who was the principal of the Nassau Technical College at the time. And I came to the Bahamas on the 27th of December, 1968, to start work on the 1st of January, so I thought, at the Nassau Technical Center, teaching math, science. And it turned out I'd also taught the electrical licensing courses, because the year before that, they had passed a law that they wanted people to have a single-phase license to work on houses, etc., and a three-phase license to work on industrial buildings like hotels and stuff like that. So I came here to teach math, science, and electrical licensing.
So now it's 1968. You're inside the Bahamas. You're here teaching electrical and math and whatever, you're here, right?
Correct.
I want to know your initial feeling coming through the airport. Describe the Bahamas circa 1968.
Well, it was kind of like early evening, I think, maybe about, it was dark. I remember that. And the drive from the airport, I was met by Ken Warhurst, who was the head of the math and science department at that time. And the drive from the airport, it was magical. I was so struck by the palm trees with the white luminous paint on the bottom 6 feet, about 6 feet high, luminous paint. And it was kind of a December evening, but it was kind of balmy. You know, it was warmer, obviously, than the snow in England I had just left. Mm-hmm. As we went into the hotel, the Royal Victoria Hotel, is where the ministry put us up for the first month, little Jonas Calypsonians were playing Somewhere My Love from Dr. Zhivago in the treehouse. And it just felt welcoming straight away. You know what I mean? You felt that peace. It was such a beautiful feeling. And we used to eat. The ministry paid our board, you know, sleeping and everything. But we had to pay for our own meals. So we'd have breakfast in the hotel restaurant. And then we would have dinner either in the hotel restaurant or Kentucky Fried. Or there was a Chinese restaurant anyway on Charlotte Street. We used to eat there. We used to call it a golden cockroach because there were so many cockroaches. But in that hotel, there was, in the restaurant, Little Joe was playing. And, you know, when he played Little Bird, Yellow Bird, I just loved that song. And then, you know, shame and scandal in the family. We used to laugh.
So they had a Bohemian or Calypsonian flair inside the hotel.
Yeah, Little Joe. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, the hotels at that time, like we used to go out to Coral Harbour on a lunchtime, and Cecil Dorset would be playing with his steel band. Mm-hmm. The Emerald Beach Hotel, which is gone now, had a 6 o'clock Calypso band, you know, a local band. And Bay Street was humming with nightclubs and bars and quality shops, not the T-shirts and hair braiding and stuff. And, you know, what the tourists tell me when they come to the museum is that it's the same whichever port you go in the Caribbean, the same T-shirts, hair braiding, jewellery. And so by the time they come to the Bahamas, they don't really spend much.
You came into the Bahamas in 1968, a year after majority rule, right? The Bahamas was once a colony, is transitioning from being a colony now. I want to know, as a expat, hired by the government to, what I call, empower or help the country transition, how was the climate of the Bahamas in terms of politics, in terms of how they embrace expats, the local persons here?
Well, when I came, there was actually a lot of expats. I mean, the air stewardesses, air hostesses, secretaries in shops, and they were mostly either British, Canadian, American, plenty of accountants, English teachers. Was pretty still a colonial society, I would say, at that time.
And again, you being British and coming to a colony with majority of black people, right? In our narrative, our official narrative of the Bahamas, they said racism was prevalent. There was some sort of a subtle apartheid that colored people couldn't go this place and expats controlled the environment. Did you witness that? Was that something that clear and stark and blatant?
No, it wasn't really. I mean, I knew local white people that thought less of the colored population, but in my experience, I've always been friendly and wonderfully comfortable with black, white, yellow, any kind of.
You live in Zambia around black people. I understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I never grew up with many black people in England at the time I grew up. Mm-hmm. But in Wirral, when I was apprentice, I had two friends from Trinidad, two black boy teenagers, if you like. From Wirral used to be the center for students from all around the world for engineering. So I met a lot of Nigerians, Chinese, Indians, mm-hmm. And these two guys from Trinidad. And I was really friendly with Dick Hayden Farrell, which was a main, and Trevor Diesenthal I was friendly with. So that was it. When I went to Zambia, I was kind of horrified by I worked with a lot of white South Africans who disliked called them Kaffirs and that sort of thing. Didn't like them. But I was running with Africans. I coached an African team in Dola United. I played cricket with 10 Pakistanis in the team. And it was just normal friendship that you have, you know. So I when I came here, all the students that I taught in Nassau Technical College were black. There's maybe two white people, but that's about it.
You married an aristocrat white, into an aristocrat white family.
She wouldn't call it an aristocrat, but
the Paul Albury. Everybody in the Bahamas know who Paul Albury is, the historian, the one who narrated the entire history of the Bahamas. He was big thing. I want to know your experience in doing that, being English. Were you welcomed, by the way, you being an expat into this, what I would call an aristocrat, bohemian white family?
Yeah, well, when I first came, I got to relate this because while I was in the Royal Victoria and my friend Ray Kennedy, well, he became a friend, Ray Kennedy came out and he played rugby. I used to train on Eastern Parade with the Nassau rugby team. And Ray and I were the only two whites, I think, there. Doyle Burrows, Boozy Rule, Barry Farrington. And somebody who I knew the name of from England. I was friendly with two of Britain's milers, John Anderson and John Hill, and I worked with John Hill, and I used to train with him every day. And John Hill said to me, if you're going to the Bahamas, you got to look up Tommy Robinson, because he knew Tommy Robinson from running international sports, especially the Commonwealth Games in 1958. So, and I met Tommy, and that was a great place. Tommy was still running in those days. I remember this stadium one day. You wouldn't believe this, but the 100 yards had six false starts before then. So back to the story, I trained on Eastern Parade. Then, after about 5 weeks, I was here 5 weeks, I entered the, it was a Gulf Oil road race, 8.3 miles. And I managed to win that. And along second to me was somebody I think you might know as Fast Eddie Dames. Yes. He was second in the race. He's a big Junkanoo man. Mm-hmm. Third in the race was Terry Miller, Leslie Miller's brother. Terry, mm-hmm. who was a good runner, and now he's in some like drug foundation or mm-hmm. something. So that sort of jumped me up, I guess, to be kind of well-known early on. I think I told you last week that I met Dave Jenner and we went to Junkanoo together, and Dave used to pick me up and take me to the McAlpine soccer training at mm-hmm. Government High School, which is now mm-hmm. university. I trained with the McAlpine soccer team as well as the rugby team at the same time. I used to train every day, you know, I ran, played soccer, did whatever sport I could every day. I was so keen on sports. So I used to go and watch the McAlpines play soccer on Fort Charlotte. You know, Fort Charlotte was the soccer mm-hmm. pitch it in, and many, many supporters, Haitians. A guy came up to me called Trevor Davis. He was a Welshman who had been here with the Armed Forces of Britain, and married a Spanish Wells girl, Marina Kelly. Trevor was the manager coach of the Paradise Island soccer team. So he asked me, did I play soccer? I said, yeah, I can play soccer. So I signed up for the Paradise Island team with a good amount of Italians and Spanish speakers from casino workers from PI. Trevor was married to Marina Kelly, and at the end of the first few months, he invited me to Spanish Wells for a week holiday with his wife's mother's home. So I spent a week in Spanish Wells and made friends, you know, with people there. And through Marina, they were in a group of people who worshipped at Trinity Methodist Church. And I got to go to, I'm not sure if Chuck Kamarich was Bahamian or American, but his wife was definitely Bahamian. And I used to play Rook with Donnie Burroughs, Trevor. Boy, I can't remember the guy's name now. But anyway, with a group of Conky Jewels, as you would call them, and friends, you know, made friends with them. So it worked out all right.
So how did you meet your wife? And I want a narrative on your father-in-law, Paul Albury, because I want to put in the record his significance.
Okay. I did 3 years at the Technical Center, and towards the end of that, I was offered a job to be a superintendent on electrical superintendent building a hotel in Jamaica, which I did for nearly 2 years, came back in 73. When I came back in 1973, I had played rugby in Jamaica, and I was staying at the Glen Eagles Hotel. You know the Glen Eagles Hotel on the corner of Village Road and Shirley Street?
Yeah.
And how would it go? I lost track.
You tell me how you met your wife.
Okay. The McAlpines, oh yeah, I was staying at the Glen Eagles and I used to run each evening from the Glen Eagles to the bridge and back again just to keep in shape. Mm-hmm. And Dick Wilson from the McAlpines team said, Jimmy, he looked me up, he said, Jimmy, would you play for McAlpines? So I said I would. At the same time, I was going along. We had some scrap rugby games at this Tommy Robinson Stadium, and in one of these scrap games, I clashed with Mike Neville and hurt my shin. But he broke his leg in five places. You know, Dr. Mike Neville, the psychologist, and I was so upset about that. I just went off the pitch and sat on the bleachers to watch the rest of the game. And while I was on the bleachers, I met a couple called Craig and Betty Weinseck, who taught at St. Andrew's School. Well, that evening happened to be a McAlpine's fundraising party at the Buena Vista Hotel on Delancey Street. At 9 o'clock, it was my time to be on the bar. So I went to the bar at 9 o'clock, and it was a little busy. Craig Weinseck, who I'd met that afternoon, came and he ordered three drinks. And he says, oh, you're a bit busy, Jim. I says, yeah, you find somebody to help me. And you know who he brought along?
Who did he bring along?
Anne Aubrey.
Your future wife?
My future wife. So we laughed and chatted with mixing the drinks and everything. And then we danced and we found out, right, we love music and we love dancing. That was the first connection. I hadn't realized it, but she used to come to the McAlpine soccer games. And you wouldn't believe this. The day I was so intrigued by her when I saw this game, she had a long flowing African dress with the patterns just more like your shirt that you've got on now. Goulevin beads round her neck that she brought from Morocco, Jesus sandals, a brown felt hat, and with a little dog called Chunga, which she'd brought from Spain. Chunga means joke, and the dog only understood Spanish. And in later years, you know, when in later times when we were together, I had to learn Spanish to talk to the dog. Chunga, finger key, yes. Vamos a la playa. Mm-hmm. And then we had a 17-foot Boston whaler. And the people in Harbour Island used to, instead of Chunga, Venga, when I used to call it, they called it Chunga Wanga. Mm-hmm. So we called the boat Chunga Wanga. The first time I kind of knew I was in love with Anne was we had gone to Harbour Island for a weekend, and we used to be able to catch a ride with Roy Schmidt, who, with his wife Moira, had the Remora Bay Hotel. Remora is a clever, what do you call it, anagram? No. What do you call it, where you say Roy and Moira? So they call it Remora, which is like a fish. So we went to Harbour Island on the plane, but coming back, we hitched a ride on a boat belonging to Penny, Dee Dee McCoy's sister. On that boat, as we were traveling back, Anne suddenly sprang on me. I've got an exam to write. I says, when's the deadline? She says, oh, I've got to have it in for tomorrow morning. And this is like 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. So we lay in the cabin in the boat and compose this exam? Well, luckily, I had studied the poems of Wordsworth from a GCE. I had studied the play Macbeth by Shakespeare for the GCE. And a Dickens novel that I had read, I cannot remember which one it was. I think it was Nicholas Nickleby, but I'm not sure. So we composed this exam together. And, you know, that sort of went down in the depth. And I remembered my history lessons and literature lessons with Mrs. Bagley at school. And that awakened, like, the interest in literature again. And when Anne was teaching at St. Andrews, the Red Pony, Steinbeck, and not Steinbeck, the other guy, the Red Pony, and of Mice and Men. Steinbeck, yeah. And I used to look up the Rose Bennett's encyclopedia, and I gradually sort of start to move towards literature, you know.
Okay. And, of course, I wanted a narrative of Paul Aubrey, your wife's father. But I know that he was a UBP senator. And I'm trying to get the temperament of the Bahamas at a particular time, right? UBP being United Bohemian Party. And now we know they had the PLP and there was adversaries in the politics, right? And you mentioned St. Andrews and that your wife taught at St. Andrews. And I'm trying to create the narrative or the temperature of the Bahamas at this time. I know how St. Andrews started.
1948.
And I know why they started.
Because QC went integrated.
So QC, Queens College, which was an all-white school, right, changed and integrated black people into school. It'll be because of that. Parents of students left and formed their own school.
Correct.
Right? And I want to know the narrative of Paul Aubrey, right, the UBP senator, and he had involvement in St. Andrews. And I want to know that narrative also.
Yeah. Well, just one point about Queen's College, you know, it wasn't strictly white, you know. They accepted kind of passing white people, as you say, from an early time because of the financial benefits. They wouldn't have been able to operate with just the white personnel. Mm-hmm. So like people like Gail Saunders and the Eldons and people like that.
Light-skinned people.
Light-skinned people, like Claude Smith. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, actually, Claude Smith was Paul Aubrey, Joan Brown, who became Mrs. Aubrey, and Claude Smith were rivals at QC in the late 1930s to be the top scholar. But my mother-in-law, Mrs. Joan Aubrey, was the top scholar. Mm-hmm. She got the Eleanor Parkinson Prize. Which way to go to explain this? With my awakened ideas of literature, and it just so happened that at the same time, I was playing soccer, rugby, and hockey, and training for them all the time. And then I hurt my back. Actually, I hurt my back in Princeton, representing the Bahamas hockey team at Princeton University. Mm-hmm. And Anne gave me a camera. Taking pictures, I wanted to improve, and so I started studying art. Studying art, I came across Raphael's painting of the School of Athens, and then I got interested in philosophy, started to read philosophy. And when I went to college in Britain again to study philosophy and religion, I came back and Paul Aubrey sent me to the archives to study and write the religion chapter of the Harbour Island story. You wanted to know about Paul.
Yes.
Paul Aubrey grew up in Harbour Island. He loved school. He loved learning and everything. He graduated from Harbour Island Old Age School at the age of 14, and then he taught as a monitor there for a year. And then he came to Nassau and did two things. He enrolled for Form 4 at Queen's College, and he worked in the evenings as for telecoms, what became Patelco. Yeah. In 1943, he fell in love with Joan Aubrey at school, Joan Brown Aubrey at school. In 1943, he joined the Canadian Royal Navy and was promoted to an officer the next year. After the war, he enrolled first at Dawson College and then at the McGill University and became a dentist. Setting up a practice dentistry in Nassau, he then became the president of the Dental Association. Because of his boating skills, he became Commodore of the Nassau Yacht Club. He became chairman of the board of St. Andrew's School, and in that role, he was the one that introduced the first black student at St. Andrew's School, who was Raleigh Butler. Son of
Raleigh's son.
And the next year, there were four more black students in St. Andrews. We know the PLP won in 67, but had to have a re-election in 1968. He stood for the Comerville district, but lost to Sir Arlington Butler, who was the head of the Olympic Committee for a while, too. So he was a UB. Because he got the most votes of the UBP in the elections, he was invited to be a senator. I think Sir Rowland invited him to be a senator. And he was a senator for 2 or 3 years in his 70s. From... No, was it 1975, he produced the book, The Story of the Bahamas. He was a founding member of Rotary. That was the thing. There was 28 founder members of Rotary. He was one. Dr. Andrew Esfagas was another, his good friend. He was the second president of East Rotary Club. And I've got to say, in his inaugural speech, which I printed in my book, Paul Aubrey, A Man and His Writings, he said that the best way to get over the color problem was to become friends. Because if you have friends, then more things come from that. So he... In his boyhood, he had slept toe-to-tail with a guy called, what's his name, Homer, who used to bring sheep for his father from Palmetto Point to Harbour Island and stay overnight. And staying overnight, he slept with Paul in the bed. Mm-hmm. So he was very used. And in Harbour Island in those days, the black and white people just... mixed. Mm-hmm. And you know, just on that, I remember a talk by George Mackey. George Mackey was a PLP.
Lieutenant Foxham.
Yeah. And Jimmy Knowles. Mm-hmm. They both lived in Fox Hill. George Mackey told a story that he was so friendly with Jimmy Knowles that on a Saturday they would walk towards town to go to a Saturday matinee. George would have to go to the Capitol Theatre on Market Street, Jimmy to the Savoy. And then on the way back, they would meet up, talk about the movie, and walk home together. Mm. So I got the feeling that the colour problem was mainly in kind of institutional places like the cinema and the church and hotels. In fact, the hotels, Rotary didn't get started until the 1962 or 3, I think it was, because a guy had tried to start it in 53, but the Sheraton British Colonial wouldn't allow black people to mix, and of course Rotary was open to black or white.
Mm-hmm. You've met Sir Lyndon when you were a younger man.
I didn't actually meet Sir Lyndon. I lived about 50 yards from where he lived.
And where is that?
On Regency Park. Mm-hmm. I know his children used to play in the street, and I kind of maybe could see them by sight, but I never met him. Mm-hmm. The house I lived in, this is interesting now, the house I lived in Regency Park belonged to Henry Stowe.
Oh.
Henry Stowe was the man, company, who put the electrics.
Henry F. Stowe.
Henry F. Stowe put the electrics in first, the Carmichael drive-in cinema, and then the Prince Charles drive-in cinema. I don't know how many years they lasted, maybe about 10 years, but the drive-ins were great, great. They used to go to drive the car, put a speaker in your car and watch two or three movies. It's good. Yeah, Henry Stowe. And then I taught two of his sons too.
Yeah?
Yeah, Stephen, who's still with the company, I think, and Alex, who became, he became a senator in one of the PLP.
Nice.
Thanks.
Mrs. Lola, we have a brief commercial break. We'll continue this story. Let's take this commercial break and then continue it, right? Guide and Read an AM.
Of the Bahamas Games are on the way. July 7th through the 15th. Get ready for inter-island sporting competition in the spirit of unity and camaraderie. Which island is gonna win? It's the Bahamas Games. Our nation, our talent, our games. And look out for the V Games crew coming to your island soon. For more information, call 809-1242 or visit thebahamasgames.org.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Wait, you know what's going down tomorrow?
Nobody, what happening?
Joe bringing the knife to school? He could do Junior in?
For what?
Well, he fool with Joe girl.
Mother sick. And you know Junior don't back down for nothing. So that means you got a big fight tomorrow.
So whose side you want?
Side? I trying to stay in school, not Simpson fan. You gotta tell somebody about this fight.
Tell somebody? I ain't no snitch. I mean cool, you know.
Wait, if you so cool, then you need to stay in school and stay out of the fight.
Yeah, but if I don't hang on Joe's side, him and he boys coming for me next.
Alright, so we definitely gotta tell somebody. We gotta prevent the fight.
What I say, I don't want nobody call me snitch.
We could just call Crime Stoppers. You could report what you know, and nobody gotta know it's you.
So how do I work?
All you gotta do is call them, or you text them through the Crack Crime Bahamas app, and nobody can know it's you.
Then the police come looking for me for more info, and when they finish with them, come looking for me?
When you call Crime Stoppers, the calls go directly to Miami, and they don't ask nothing about you. Then you can get the pen from them, and you can claim a reward later using that same pen.
Plus, everything's scrambled, so nobody can read what you said.
Calls 308-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
And welcome back to Guide and Radio AM. We're talking to Jim Lawler, who's a historian here. He is recanting his journey from England to the Bahamas and how the Bahamas has changed, right? And he's doing that by telling stories about him meeting his wife, his father-in-law, him working to the Bahamas. Even we delve in some one or two race relations back then and doing a compare and contrast then. But I want to know, how has the Bahamas changed from when you came here, first came here?
Oh, boy. You know, when I first came here, there was only one traffic light on Mackay Street. And then a year later, it was five, and then 10. You know, it was just...
Growing.
And, you know, living in Regency Park, I could leave my door open, my windows open, my car unlocked. No teething, you know. Mm-hmm. But around about 1975, that sort of started the change.
What happened around 75?
I think that was when more or less the drug trade kind of start mm-hmm. escalating, you know. But, yeah, I mean, it was so pleasant in those days. I mean, I still love it.
Where all have you taught being here in the Bahamas?
Okay, well, I started off at the Nassau Technical Center, which became merged with the Nassau Technical College the next year. Then it became the C.R. Walker Technical College. And then it became the Soldier Road campus of the College of the Bahamas, when the College of Bahamas started in 1974 under the first president, John Knowles. Interesting time about that. I had to convert the program from a year-long English style to the American semester system with credits. Mm-hmm. And man, that was so difficult to do because every teacher wanted more time mm-hmm. than I could give them in that period, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk.
And then,
go ahead.
And then the next school I taught at was C.C. Sweeting. Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting time, because a lot of those teachers from C.C. Sweeting actually became principals and vice principals of other schools in later years. Then I went to England, I did that degree. I came back and I taught 3 years at St. John's with part-time at the College of the Bahamas teaching philosophy. Then I spent 5 years at QC as part-time teacher, part-time guidance counselor. Mm-hmm. Then I went to St. John's as full-time guidance counselor for 10 years. At the end of that 10 years, I decided at 60, I'd like to go and do some teaching. I wanted to teach. By that time, I was into history, so I wanted to teach some history. Mm-hmm. So they had some difficulty and they wanted me to transfer to St. Anne's. So I taught at St. Anne's religion, history, and English at St. Anne's. And then when I retired, I started work for St. Andrews. Was sort of a substitute teacher. And then as the years went by, I sometimes got to like a 6-month contract, a 4-month contract, a 10-week contract. When people left or were sick and that sort of thing.
I want to ask you this question. If I tell you the PLP was the first political party in the Bahamas, what would you respond?
I would say, no, it wasn't.
So what was the first political party?
The first political parties were in the 1850s, the Church Party, which was the Anglicans, and the opposition, which was an amalgamation of Methodists, Presbyterians, and Baptists.
We can talk about that. We can talk about that next time we come. This has been Guardian Radio in the AM with C.A. Nuri. Have a wonderful day.